It's hard to overstate the impact that Uber has had on transportation, particularly in more urban areas. The peer-to-peer transportation model, one that allows anyone with a decent car to become a supplier, has rapidly spread around the world. And it was Uber, led by its flamboyant CEO, Travis Kalanick, that created and perfected the model.
The Uber story is one of stunningly rapid growth, but the dark side of the Uber culture is also legendary. A company as disruptive of an industry as regulated by taxi cab drivers will inevitably run into friction with regulators. Uber's approach was to simply forge ahead using aggressive tactics of questionable legality. Uber was a ruthless competitor, and while the company was dependent on its thousands of drivers, it showed little concern for their well-being. While Silicon Valley is known for its white male-dominated culture, Uber was perhaps the poster child of excess and frat boy environment. The dominant figure behind the Uber culture was its flamboyant CEO, Travis Kalanick. Kalanick's work ethic was legendary as he pushed all of his employees to have a singular focus on growing the business. Just as legendary, perhaps, were also the lavish parties and other excesses. And while Uber had an IPO earlier this year, the founder has been unceremoniously deposed months before the IPO, notwithstanding, due to an unusual set of corporate protections he had woven into the company's legal structure.
The story of Kalanick, who I hope Mike Isaacs will tell us if we're pronouncing correctly, and how he came to lose control of the mammoth he founded is captured in a riveting new book by New York Times writer Mike Isaac, a book that came out last week and is already number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book is super pumped, and as Doug said, we are super pumped to have Mike Isaac joining us on Mountain Money this morning. Good morning, Mike, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, let's start by telling the audience why you chose the title Super Pumped. Where did it come from, and how did it get presented to the Uber employees?
Yeah, totally. So I picked it because it was basically emblematic of a lot of the bro culture at this company. Travis Kalanick is the pronunciation. I struggled with that for a while. He basically wanted to provide this list of corporate values for the company, and he had modeled Uber after the vein of Amazon for a long time. Amazon has its own list of 14 internal values that it sort of promotes to its workers. Uber's version of that was essentially to run it through a bro-speak translation engine, and came up with values like always be hustling, and super pumped was probably one of the most prominent ones. And the idea that all of the employees needed to be super pumped to take on the day, and they even evaluated employees on their levels of super pumpedness when they worked for Uber. So it was pretty emblematic.
In the book, you describe I think it was a Las Vegas retreat where these values were discussed at some length. It's quite a picture that you paint. Can you describe to the audience sort of the nature of the kinds of retreats like this that Uber was having?
Yeah, you know, one of the ways I describe Uber, its culture and the rise and eventual fall of the founder and the company over the past 10 years is kind of an admixture of Thomas Hobbes meets Wolf of Wall Street and Animal House. It was basically in 2015... Uber had met this internal milestone on the number of trips it had taken. And so Travis Kalanick's idea was to basically reward the entire company with a giant party in the desert. So the company spent $25 million flying its entirely employee base out to Las Vegas, put them all up in hotels for a week, let them go to private parties, different nightly events, presented all this stuff on stage, and the final big corporate event was the private performance from Beyonce, who was paid in about $6 million in equity, which quickly rose in value afterwards. So the money was free-flowing, and the party was pretty good, at least.
And just to be clear, when we talk about Uber employees, we are not talking about the drivers.
That's right. You know, they make a very clear distinction. Their entire business model is predicated on not having as many employees as possible. So while they have probably around 14,000, 15,000 actual employees working at Uber offices, They have more than, I want to say, 2 or 3 million contract drivers working for them around the world. And that's very important to their business that they don't offer them full benefits that they would an employee.
Yeah, and that's an important topic. We may get to that, we may not. But I want to go to the opening of your book where you talk about, excuse me, how Uber launched in Portland. And by the time Uber, you know, Utah was not a primary market for Uber. By the time Uber got here, the battles had already been fought in other municipalities. It was pretty genteel what we saw here. It was a little disruptive, but not that big. The biggest challenge was they weren't allowed to pick up at the airport for many, many months, if not years. But Portland was a different story. They had regulators out downloading the Uber app, trying to catch Uber drivers and give them thousands of dollars in municipality fines for being Uber drivers. Talk to us about how Uber initially got into cities that did not want them.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to think about now just because Uber is so prevalent in cities across the United States as well as the world, but back in, you know, the early days, they were essentially offering this service where anyone can drive a car for them, and they weren't, you know, licensed taxi operators. They didn't have medallions. It was pretty radical at the time. And so they would face these battles pushing into cities like Portland was one example, but Philadelphia was another big one. They had issues in New York, a lot of different places around the country. And the idea was, you know, regulators can't really stop us if they can't catch us. And if we push headlong into the city and give the people something that they didn't know they wanted until we give it to them, eventually they will come to our aid and want Uber more than they, you know, trust the government to stop us. So what they would do, in the case of Portland and other cities, they use this software tool that they created called internally codenamed called Grayball, which basically hid the ability to ask regulators to pick up cars and pick them up, so they were able to shield themselves, cloak themselves in darkness, so they wouldn't be able to have their drivers pulled over and give them tickets.
Just to be clear, so for our audience, Uber was able to identify who the regulators were, and when they downloaded the app from the App Store, they got a different version of the app, which would protect the drivers. It would hide the drivers. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, the legal implications around that. We at the Times reported that story in 2017. It was pretty hidden, and then the legal implications around that were pretty questionable at best.
It's stunning. It's a really clever thing, and they did it with a number of different ways of identifying the city employees. And they would do, I think you talked about geofencing, and you talked about sort of unleashing all kinds of personal sort of searches to identify who might be a city employee. It's really pretty extraordinary story of a company that was such a scofflaw that they just, I guess, as you said before, they figured that if they could just get there first, if they could just get a user base, then that user base would turn against the regulators if it tried to get them out.
Yeah, you know, and to your point earlier, I think, a lot of the question now from technologists is what do the means justify the ends? Because Uber is essentially ubiquitous in a lot of U.S. cities and around the world, and people do seem to enjoy it, and they may have done some pretty outlandish things to get there, but at the same time, it seems to have worked. So, you know, morals and ethics aside, I guess the question is it worth pushing this far, pushing their boundaries that far just to get to that tipping point?
You know, and oftentimes money is behind this. If you can get enough dollars behind your cause, that's going to help you, obviously. Building a company like Uber was incredibly expensive. They've raised over $25 billion in private capital before going public earlier this year. That's a ton of money, but some of their first money came in from a firm known as Benchmark, which is famous back in the day, I guess 20 years ago now, for being the first investors in eBay. They were also one of the first investors in Uber, led by a venture capitalist by the name of Bill Gurley. You mentioned in the book that Gurley was very eager to get in on the Uber investment, but you also mentioned that Uber was interested in having Benchmark. Why was Uber so interested in having Benchmark on board?
Yeah, so in Silicon Valley, the idea that you get investments, you know, that your company gets investments from these marquee firms early on is kind of a branding thing. You know, if my startup gets an investment from Bill Gurley, this legendary venture capitalist, and it's from Benchmark, blue chip firm, I guess, it means something. You have a stamp of approval about your company, and it makes it easier later on to raise larger amounts of money from different firms. So it's definitely this pedigree that's very important as young startups in the Valley try to raise money. And Gurley was a very key figure in this company until later on when he becomes another key antagonist of the founder once things go south.
You describe Kalanick's obsession with competitors and Lyft in particular. I mean, we've talked a little bit about how vicious they were in dealing with regulators in these various cities using technological tricks. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, the kinds of tactics that Kalanick deployed to deal with his competitors?
Yeah, one of the things that we talk about in the book is this really sprawling security team and these basically counterintelligence teams that the company deploys to fight competitors. One of Kalanick's real obsessions with winning always involved, almost essentially spying on all of his competitors, like Lyft, especially in the United States, and then Didi, a Chinese ride-hailing company, as well as a bunch of different other ones across different continents. And that would include, you know, hiring folks like ex-NSA, CIA, and FBI contractors to follow their competitive employees. That included building these programs, one of which was called HELL, an internal monitoring system to track where Lyft drivers were at all times. They had these different systems to shut off offices remotely when they would run into, maybe if they had a raid by government officials, they could shut down all of their computers remotely, which might, again, run afoul of the law. So it's a lot of things that, you know, Uber at the time would argue were in ethically or legal gray areas, and they wanted to just exploit those gray areas as much as they could.
And these aggressive tactics worked for Uber and worked for Travis until they didn't. And eventually there was a reckoning, a catching up. Tell us the beginning of the fall of Travis, how that came to be, and then we'll ask some questions about the fall.
Sure, totally. So I think the real turning point, if you can remember back in 2017, there were a number of scandals, one of which involved some high-level employees at an escort bar in South Korea, as well as, you know, the presence of Travis and one of his top lieutenants. And then the real tipping point was an ex-employee posted a blog post about her time at Uber and serial harassment from her managers and sort of sexual harassment, and a lot of the problems that women inside the company faced that really underscored how toxic the culture was and had grown under Kalanick and only continued to grow until the employees themselves just weren't going to take it.
Yeah, the Susan Fowler blog was a pretty stunning story when she talks about how on her first day she is, you know, to use a colloquial term, hit upon by her supervisor. Describe a little bit about what she said and what happened to her and why this had such an impact when it was that blog got resent around the world.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think it was really, besides the actual content of the blog post, which, you know, included, you know, her first day walking into her new engineering team and her manager inviting her into his open relationship and her feeling pressured into, like, having to deal with this guy until she could finally get the heck out of there. You know, I think it really came at a key time, too. This was probably a few months before The Harvey Weinstein investigations and the Me Too movement really took off, and I think it was just primed for timing that, you know, empowered a lot of women inside of the company as well as other tech companies in Silicon Valley that were facing similar problems. But it really resonated with women inside of Uber who had just faced systematic harassment and discrimination, as well as suffered at the hands of a sort of party bro culture that permeated the entire company.
You know, the Fowler blog describes a situation that sort of makes one ask, wouldn't a multi-billion-dollar company with a worldwide reach like Uber have a fairly robust HR and legal function? And it sure doesn't sound like that's the way it was.
It didn't. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You would think so. One of the things that Kalanick really tried to push is that we're this scrappy company. We may be big, but we're not a big, boring entity like Oracle, right? We want to stay lean, and that unfortunately translated to having no actual internal processes to deal with this sort of stuff. So HR was in shambles. They didn't actually take any complaints seriously. Usually you were protected as a manager if you were able to hit your numbers or be, you know, sort of important to the org, and that really came at the expense of a lot of folks who were suffering inside.
Well, let me build on Roger's question and talk about corporate governance. So Bill Gurley, who we talked about earlier, the venture capitalist at Benchmark Capital, one of Uber's earlier investors. I graduated business school when the internet first started taking off in 1995, and one of my classmates ended up being the co-founder of eBay. eBay has a beautiful culture, a very supportive culture, a place that many, many people love working. And so clearly, you know, Benchmark was their only venture capital investor at the time. And they clearly valued that type of culture and played a role in helping to create it. What role did Gurley play early on in helping to maybe curtail this culture and or identify and bring up potential warning signs that things were getting out of hand?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the big questions that I think about towards the end of the book, when he ends up becoming a figure to aid in the reckoning of Uber. And so I think one of the things early on that VCs sometimes do is really obsess on growth and growing as quickly as possible and pushing the company to move outwards if that's what was needed. And I think Gurley was very instrumental in doing that, and he's got a brilliant mind for marketplaces, and the eBay being the foremost marketplace, but Uber ended up being a different kind of marketplace that he wanted to invest in. So I think he was instrumental in helping the company grow and helping Travis, sort of strategize. I think he was less able to, or perhaps less willing to focus on culture and like how that formed inside of Uber over time. And I think some of his detractors would say, you know, VCs kind of were willing to turn a blind eye to any problems if the company was just going along well. I will say he tried to put in some controls with different lieutenants alongside of Travis to rein him in, but, you know, ultimately Travis started becoming tired of Gurley's complaints or concerns when Travis felt like the VC was too worried about culture and just ended up being a complainer. And so Travis ended up shutting Gurley out over time, basically.
You know, the end of the book, you mentioned earlier that there were elements of The Wolf of Wall Street, and the end of the book really is like a movie as things, you know, deteriorate for Kalanick. He had some extraordinary corporate governance protections that he built in order to try to maintain control. But at the end, they crumbled. Can you talk a little bit about what those were and how ultimately the investors were able to force him out?
Yeah, so early on, one of the things that I think was formative to Travis's psyche was just this idea that VCs will always stab him in the back at the end. He had an early startup where he got betrayed by one of his earliest VCs. And over time, he ended up just trying to put a lot of different protections for himself into Uber's corporate charter, one of which included the ability to name extra board members who he could just handpick and decide to keep on his side and be his supporters over time. So there are a lot of protections for himself up and until the end of the company, end of his tenure at the company, and he made sure that he was just very well protected. I think ultimately, you know, as I get to in the book, I don't want to give away too much, but there was essentially a coup and a willingness by some investors to just take this fight into a very public domain if Travis wasn't willing to step down as a leader because of the actions of the company. And this leverage against him ultimately worked. And I think there were a number of other factors in it, one of which was, you know, tragedy in Travis's personal life. But it ended up becoming a pretty bloody and public fight that worked against Travis's favor.
And yeah. I think... Go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to share at the opening of your book, you share a quote by Machiavelli, which talks about... I'll just read part of it. You must know there are two ways of contesting, the one by law, the other by force, and then it goes on. And I think it's a great open, it's a great prelude to the book because it does, you know, Uber obviously chose the use of force to open markets, and maybe they needed to do that in order for a company like Uber to exist. But it also foreshadows the ending of Travis's rule that it would be messy. You mentioned that there were some things that the board was going to go public with. I was struck at the end at how much negative press there was on almost a daily basis on Travis. There was that webcam of him arguing with one of his Uber drivers. There was just so much out there. And I'm wondering, was that a concerted effort by Travis's enemies to get that out, to force the issue at hand?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think, you know, I think that it was just years of baggage coming back to haunt Travis the exact wrong time. And I think, you know, Uber made a lot of enemies along the way as it pushed through into all of these cities. And to your to that early quote, you know, they did it by force, and it worked for a very long time until it stopped working. And I think all of the people who were sort of left in his wake over time, since this moment of weakness around the company and these really explosive leaks all started happening one after another over a very short period of time that I think just damaged him, his credibility, his willingness to be on top, or his ability to be on top without people sort of wishing that he needed to go, all in very short order. And I think that was the sort of last straw that enacted the board members and the investors who were part of this coup to act against him because of this real negative push all at one after the other.
One of the things that comes out in the book is a sort of lack of concern about the well-being of the drivers themselves, that they were sort of held at a distance. And I think you know, we have new developments as late as last week with the California legislature passing a new law that would really, I think, change the dynamic of the relationship between Uber and its drivers. How do you think this is going to play out? Are we going to see, you know, actually regulatory efforts to sort of change that relationship?
Yeah, for a very long time, I think a real big miscalculation was Travis and Uber's just complete lack of care or concern for driver well-being. A lot of drivers just felt totally jerked around by Uber's constantly fluctuating prices and payment structures. You know, there'd be huge promises of money up front, only for months later to prices to plummet, essentially. And so I think drivers got really upset over time. And now recently with AB5 in California and some other sort of movements, you're seeing these real big pushes to form driver unions or gain additional protections. And I think the events that happen in California, the worry for Uber is that they will continue to spread to other states. I think looking at Seattle and in Washington, are there going to be similar bills in different states in the U.S.? Right now, I think the what I hear from drivers is as much support as I do detractors. You know, I think a lot of drivers are like to say that, look, I don't want to be an employee. I like to do my sort of set my own schedule and work on my own time. And if I want to pay my own benefits, I can. So my guess is there's going to be some sort of compromise that Uber and other gig economy companies are negotiating with regulators, which I've heard involves maybe like a wage floor, maybe a minimum of what they would make per hour, as well as some additional negotiation benefits or kind of driver advocate.
It'll be interesting to see, and perhaps there'll be a part two to the book. Mike, we've enjoyed having you. Unfortunately, we need to wrap, but before we go, I have a two-part question for you. My producer is probably a little nervous on time, so we need to keep him short. But, you know, we've talked about a company that muscled its way in, and you can make the argument that maybe it needed to be that way. In Uber's case, it's interesting because we have a counterparty company that grew up in its shadow as well, and that is Lyft. Lyft is kind of the kinder, gentler version of Uber, but yet has also been successful. Also, at the same time Uber was fighting municipalities, so was Airbnb. And so you're a technology reporter for the New York Times. You talk to many of these companies. And so my first question for you is, you know, were the nice guys able to win as well? And what if any lesson did you take from that? And then my second question for you just briefly is, did you have a chance to talk to Travis? Has he had a chance to comment on this, on your book, and what are his thoughts?
Sure. I think, you know, to the second part, you know, Travis did not want this book to happen. I hired a fact checker from the New Yorker to help me, and we, of course, put everything to them in writing and sort of made the case to them, and they were able to push back if they wanted, but there was no real cooperation or help. And then to the first part, you know, I really think that the Valley, companies in the Valley internalized this idea that nice guys finish last. You know, Lyft might be still out there and chugging along, but Uber is a much bigger company, and the idea that you can just sort of wait and sit back without pushing for what you want is not popular out here. I think it's really, you know, move fast and break things and then take your knocks later on.
Mike, thanks for spending the time with us. Congratulations on the book, which, you know, we read a lot of business books here. This one was a page-turner, and I don't often
absolutely
say that.
It
was like a movie. I we absolutely loved it. I know why it's shooting up the New York Times bestseller list. The book is super pumped. We've been speaking with Mike Isaac. Mountain Money will be right back after this. Thanks again, Mike.